You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, everybody. On this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, I have on a inadvertent, accidental pioneer of the bourbon industry, Randy Blank, and my friend Wade Woodard. For those of you who don't know, many of you guys have heard of Randy Blank. Randy Blank was the very first barrel program advocate that kind of started a domino effect that turned into what we have today in the bourbon world. When it comes to bourbon, the snowflake, the holy grail, is a honey barrel, that perfect single barrel, hand-picked barrel of bourbon that changes your idea of what this hobby is. And Randy Blank was one of the – he was the first to basically approach places like the Pappy Van Winkle line and just say, hey, I want to buy my own barrel of something. He bought a barrel of something called Lot B from Pappy Van Winkle, affectionately known as Van Blankle, back in 2004, and it dominoed into place people like Doug Phillips purchasing his own barrels. Some of these really, really famous picks that now go for as much as $10,000 for a bottle of bourbon. It's insane. So Randy is directly responsible for the environment that we have today when it comes to private barrel picks. Places like Four Roses and Beam have their Knob Creek barrel line. They did 1,000 single barrels last year. Four Roses did 600 single barrels last year. This is something that has never been a thing, but is now what everyone is salivating at the mouth for, drooling at the mouth for. I'm very honored to have Randy on, and of course, my buddy Wade Woodard. So Wade is a consumer advocate that has been on the forefront of a grassroots campaign for the past decade of keeping labels honest. For many years, bourbon producers, rye producers, whiskey producers would lie on the label and give you this fancy story about Al Capone's original recipe from Prohibition or any number of bullshit. And Wade has helped hold these places accountable to keep consumers honest, or to keep us from being lied to. So Wade Woodard and Randy Blank, both arguably very important people in the whiskey world. I'm extremely honored. Today's episode is sponsored by Old Forester and Glendronach. They are huge sponsors of the show and supporters of this year's Whiskey Social. If you go to www.houstonwhiskeysocial.com, you will find details for this year's event where you will find both these items. We actually lined up a special tasting of the last 4 years of their birthday bourbon at this year's Whiskey Social. So if you visit Eventbrite or houstonwhiskeysocial.com, you'll find details for this year's event on July 28th. So it is the state's largest whiskey festival, 350-plus whiskeys, including what's sitting in front of you. So check it out. Get your tickets today. Cheers. All right. Welcome to the show, guys.
Howdy.
Hey, Chris. I'm excited. All right. So for those who aren't familiar, and this is probably going to be covered in our opening introduction, which is usually done, as I've said before, at the we do it after we do the show, so it'll be placed at the beginning. I've got Wade Woodard, who many of you have heard of or seen, and Randy Blank. So it's really, really important. Some of the – well, I would say 20 years ago, some really important things happened that I don't think purposely were meant to change the way that bourbon barrels were done. But I would say that you are directly responsible, you, Doug, and a few other guys who really made it super popular, and barrel programs. I mean, they weren't a thing before, and they were for some, a few accounts. I know that like bars and restaurants or certain things have done it, but as far as the bourbon world, the collector being able to go out and handpick a barrel of bourbon, that was something that you started.
So we can blame Randy.
We can blame Randy for the fervor, for the fanaticism.
Well, not exactly, but you're right. The retailers and the restaurants and some of those people were already doing single barrels. And so when I saw that and tasted it, I thought, wow, that's something maybe an individual could do or a group of individuals could do. And did one, and it just took off from there.
Made it a reality. The barrel program, I mean, for years, everything seemed like out of reach, like meaning if an individual wanted something, they needed to know, see if they can get something from a bar or see if they can get something from a liquor store. This was the first time that the consumer was able to just go directly to, and by the way, you picked a pretty unique individual to start this with. You could have gone to any bourbon distillery. You chose Julian Van Winkle to buy one of his barrels, which are now impossibly hard to, they're not doing barrel programs anymore. So it's you created the Van Blankel, right? So tell us, for those who aren't familiar with the history, tell us how it all started.
Well, certainly I enjoyed Stitzelweller whiskey, and Julian was bottling quite a bit of it back in the early 2000s, and still was for a long time. And so I approached him about doing a single barrel, and he liked the idea. He said he had done them for retailers and restaurants and bars, but he had never done one for an individual. So he liked the idea. He had recently partnered with Buffalo Trace, who didn't like the idea of going to an individual.
Why?
At that time, they were trying to get the Van Winkle products in more markets, and they didn't want to take a full barrel out of the distribution chain. So they were hesitant to do it. He and I kept pushing. I won't say the person at Buffalo Trace's name, but we kept pushing him. He finally said yes. And Julian was excited. And then he and I made it happen. It was a lot of fun.
And so in the way I understand it, you originally had asked for the 10-year-old and 107 proof, right?
Right.
And then, but you had found out that there was no longer Stitzelweller distillate completely. Like, it wasn't fully Stitzelweller distillate, so you bumped it up to the lot B12.
Well, actually, Julian recommended I do that. He says, Randy, I can't promise you what I can roll out as Stitzelweller, as 10107, but I can as the lot B. And I said, well, you know what I want. I want Stitzelweller. So that's what he did. We brought out five barrels for me to taste, and we did a lot B instead of the 10107. But I would have preferred at the time, the 10107 was my favorite.
And 10107 was a less expensive bottle, and you're buying the whole barrel. How many bottles is that going to cost? It added a lot to the cost. Of course, now we look back on it and think that cost per bottle.
Yeah. We're laughing about $30 on $30 a bottle, right?
I think tax, title, and license out of specs, it was $33.
$33 a bottle. Yeah. And now those bottles are highly coveted for significantly more money than that.
To say the least.
To say the least.
Well, it made 17 cases, and at that time I thought I had a lifetime supply of Van Winkle bourbon.
It's 12 a case.
12 a case, yeah. Yeah, 17 cases.
So I was back in Kentucky, and Randy picked up a few of the cases back there, I believe. Is that correct?
Five cases were delivered to Kentucky.
And there was a group of us that used to go and hang out in Kentucky in the spring and the fall. And I forget which one that was, but we'd hang out at a gazebo in a particular hotel, and I remember Randy taking these cases, and pretty much anybody that was there that had been active in the straightbourbon.com forums, he gave them all just one bottle to begin with. Just, here you go, have this.
Yeah.
Just super nice. We all love the whiskey. Oh man, this is great.
Well, you know, free whiskey is pretty good whiskey. You know? So people ask, how did it get its reputation? And I said, for a lot of people, it was free. So who doesn't like a bottle of free bourbon? And Van Winkle bourbon, too. So
where did the name Van Blankel come from?
One of the members on straightbourbon.com gave it that name. I believe it was Ed, gave it the name Van Blankel. And it stuck. It stuck. So it wasn't my creation. It was Ed's.
Well, part of the show is us drinking, so let's pour something up. I know I think you had said you actually brought something with you today, but let's save that for last. Have you tried the new Lincoln-Tada barrel that was recently done?
Probably not. I've enjoyed some of their.
I would
their
definitely start with this then.
Let's do it.
Well, I'd already started with the little birthday bourbon, I have a little of that too. Just give me a second here to finish this.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and get your pour here.
Yeah, you can pour. You do the pouring. That's plenty. Thank you.
Oh, you got water in there.
I'm just gonna rinse it down.
So yeah, so you mentioned straightbourbon.com before the Facebook world, and I'm doing a lot of recapping for those who aren't familiar, because a lot of us got into this in the last 10 years.
Right.
And this is all stuff that happened almost 20 years ago. So before the Facebook forums, which are now, some of them as many as 30,000 people, there was straightbourbon.com. And that's where all the... You mentioned earlier that, you know, the Willett Distillers and the Jimmy Russell and like all of them were on this one internet forum, but this long before Facebook came out.
Absolutely right.
And it's still around, correct? Yeah, I think I signed up for it, but everything happens on Facebook. So
it's still pretty active, actually. I still get on there some, but back then maybe there was 800-900 kind of members, and of that maybe 150 kind of active.
Super active.
Yeah, so it was a pretty small group.
And right.
I mean, we take the internet for granted now, but I think it's not quite 20 years ago, but maybe about 2001, 2002 that I signed up for it. Back then, if you were on the internet, it was dial-up modem.
Yeah. You know,
28K, maybe 56K if you were really lucky.
You were using your AOL disk you got at the grocery store for 3 hours.
You know, basically. So it was really kind of early on in the internet days, and some people that were probably like me. I bought a bottle of bourbon. I always like bourbon, but I buy a bottle, I bring it home, I drink it, I go to the store the next time when that was empty and bought another one. Got on this group and got to learning about who really made what, because prior to the internet, that was all kind of closely guarded, and the internet really kind of shined a lot of light on that.
And that's where bunkers were created. I know that when people get into this hobby, You may be the type of person who's buying 1 to 3 bottles a month, and within 6 months to a year of you diving headfirst into this, you're all of a sudden buying 3 to 4 bottles a week, and some of us buy the case. So it's something that's exploded. It's the reason why there's just not enough to go around. I mean, every year it seems like stuff's getting younger and younger. They're getting rid of age statements. So yeah, I would say the golden age of bourbon back then. You guys had a lot of stuff you didn't know was great that now people would go nuts over.
Well, back then the liquor store was your bunker. You didn't think about buying multiple bottles because it was always going to be on the shelf at your liquor store. And what got me onto straight bourbon is I discovered Weller Centennial, and I wanted to find out more about it. You know, what was the mash bill? Why did I like it more than others? Get on the internet, and there weren't a lot of resources, and straightbourbon.com was one of the few internet resources where you could ask questions and people had good answers, and I got very active in it. And they also had a couple of social activities. They would participate at the Sampler in Kentucky and the Bourbon Festival, so you got to meet a lot of these people that you'd met on the forums, and I made a lot of good friendships that way. So Wade's one of them. So
yeah, we originally probably joined about the same time, that Straight Bourbon forum, and I met his wife before I met him. I was living in Seattle at the time, and we were working out a swap on, I think it was a BTAC. I can't remember what.
And a birthday bourbon. I know, birthday bourbon one way or the other. Yeah. So.
And Val, his wife, was traveling to Seattle on business some. So she came up there, and I went and had dinner with her and met her and did the swap. She was our mule. So that's how I originally met Randy. I think less than a year later, we met up in Kentucky.
Right.
You mentioned the gazebo thing earlier. So I know a few people in the bourbon world have heard about the famed gazebo, but tell me a little bit about that.
There's this hotel in Bardstown. And Bardstown, if you haven't been to Kentucky, is kind of a good centralized point of visiting all the distilleries. So the hotel is the Best Western General Nelson. And in the back, they have a gazebo structure, kind of a lawn and gazebo. And for whatever reason, that was a spot that people started staying, that was going with this straight bourbon group. In the evenings, they had no problem with us all doing a bottle share. So it was probably some of the first big bottle shares. Everybody just go out to the table, set a few bottles down, have a pour whatever you wanted. And so the gazebo kind of legend came from that.
And it was a legend because the attendees were legends. Sure. Now looking back, who was there with you?
Well, the distillers back then, they didn't have a ton of visitors visiting their distilleries. And people coming from across the U.S. just to hang out and drink bourbon was new to them. So we had Parker Beam.
Craig Beam.
Jimmy Russell
and his wife would always swing by for a little bit. Yep.
Yeah.
Julian.
Oh, yeah.
Julian was always there. The Coolsveens would show up. So
Coolsveens of Willett.
Right. Yes. And back then they were still having to work to sell bourbon. It wasn't just flying off the shelves. So participating in an active group on the internet was good business. I mean, it was a way to promote
your
product.
Got your brand out there, yeah.
Exactly. So, as Wade said, so it was a bottle share, and there would be a couple of tables bigger than this, not a room for another bottle on the table, and it would be all the old stuff, the new stuff, and oftentimes people would bring some of the recently released BTACs, say the George T. Stagg, and no one would taste it because there was so much other
old
interesting
stuff.
On the table that it wouldn't even get opened over a 2 or 3 day period. So it was a lot of fun. There was no aftermarket for bourbon. So if you had it, there was not an opportunity, as some people do now, sell it. So you opened it up and drank it. You did without reservation because you hadn't paid much for it.
Right.
And the table had some incredible stuff on it back then.
This similar thing happens once a year. I think you guys host something. Technically you host it, but it's Wade's thing.
It's been back and forth.
It's been back and forth.
Place or my place.
What it was, I moved back to Houston from Seattle in, I think, 2007, and had talked to Randy and said, hey, there's a lot of people here in the Gulf Coast. Why don't we do – originally it was supposed to be like a traveling event instead of going to Kentucky in the fall. Let's go to a different city. That was the original concept. And we'll host the first one. It'll be in Houston. So we had a get-together. It was at Randy's house. We probably had 50 people come, mostly Texas, but some indie people and some all over. And we had kind of a gazebo here.
Right.
Just kind of come up with a little funny name. We named it GCBM, Gulf Coast Bourbon Maniacs.
Right.
I think that was more of a jab at the Georgia Bourbon Society, because I think they were the first ones that gave themselves a name as a group. So
everybody laughed at it.
Yeah, so we laughed at it and said, okay, if they're going to have the GBS, we'll come up with our own little nickname. But from there, it went to pretty much once a year, either Randy or I would host an event. And there's a lot of years we struggled to get 20 people there.
How long ago was this when it started?
Started in 2008.
Yeah, it's been at least 10 years, right?
Yeah, it's been 10 years. In those early years, you know, it was not that big a group.
Touching
it wasn't
go,
a lot
man.
Of people here in Houston really got into it.
Call your friends, hey, we're doing a bourbon tasting. So what?
Right. And now people go nuts.
Yeah.
Now, it's unfortunately, we just can't invite everybody that would like to come. I mean, it's just, that's why you have the Houston Whiskey Social.
Yeah.
If you want an event for 2,000 people, it's your event.
Right.
Well, I hope we don't ever get that big, but it only because of the amount of time and liability that constantly stresses me out every year.
Right.
You get 2,000 people in there, the liability issue is nerve-wracking, but I get what you're saying. So typically, so you guys do this tasting of your own version of the gazebo, and Ed Bly was here this past one.
Yeah,
right.
He came into town.
Yeah, she flew in for that one, and it was great. I mean, same thing. There's more stuff on the table than anyone can reasonably get to, even if you are pouring the tiniest pours. And it's just this. It's become its own beast.
We'd always have to remind someone their first time at either the gazebo or any of these bottle shares. It's a marathon, not a sprint. That you don't have to taste everything there. Small pours, take your time, and try not to get over-served, which is easy to do because someone new to bourbon can come in and see things they've never seen before, probably won't ever taste again, and want to try them all.
Yeah, and there's more than just one. So there's there's 20 things that I'll never see again,
right?
No longer made.
Right.
And Van Blanco wasn't the only thing that you did, right? You also, it didn't stop there, and it kind of spread a little bit. Tell me a little bit where it went from there.
Well, there were certainly several people that did some single barrels after mine. I brought an example of a group out on the West Coast that did them. And then another StraightBourbon.com member, Cliff, formed a group called the Kentucky Barrel Society, and I believe there were 9 members of it. And we started doing barrel selections, too. I believe our first selection was in 05, and we did some Weller 12s, which turned out to be, they rolled out 6 barrels of Stitzel Weller to be put in Weller 12 bottles. We bought 4 barrels, 4 of the 6, as Weller 12. And back then, I think the average price was $16 or $17 a bottle. So it was everybody's house whiskey, you know, right. A Stitzel Weller, single barreled, unique labels for each of the 4 barrels. I recall Julian Van Winkle calling me and says, "Randy, I heard what y'all were able to do. How did y'all get those Stitzel Weller barrels out of Buffalo Trace's hands and put into Weller 12? And I said, "We didn't twist any arms. We just asked." And they said yes. And he was a little bit perturbed that it was that easy to get Stitzel Weller whiskey.
Matter of fact, I think someone lost their job at BTO for this. Yeah. Or was one factor involved in it?
Four different barrels of highly coveted stuff just gone.
Well, the other thing
in a bottle that was selling for $16 to $18.
When it could have gone
if I recall correctly, you really only bought 3 to begin with, and then they made a mistake and bottled the wrong barrel. And then you said, "Okay, well, we'll take that one as well."
Actually, we went in with the objective with the group of 9 people. We were going to share the purchase of 2 barrels. And so there was the group consensus, which you can kind of, that's a whole separate subject when you pick barrels, because oftentimes you're going to like a barrel, but it's not the group's favorite.
Correct, yeah.
So we had 2 consensus barrels, majority rules barrels, and there was one that that I liked better than the other 2. And so I just raised my hand, "Will you sell me that one?" And the Buffalo Trace people got together, "Sure, we'll sell one more barrel." And I had 3 or 4 other guys said, "I'm in for that too, Randy, if you want to share." So that created the 3rd barrel that we purchased as a group. And then the 4th, and mistakes happen in this process all the time at the distilleries. They accidentally bottled a 4th barrel and asked us, "Well, it's already been bottled as a single barrel. Would you like it?" And we said, "Sure." And we labeled it the 4th barrel. That was the name that it got. So,
and these are under the old paper labels, right?
Exactly, right.
Wow. And and stuff like that just doesn't happen. Now they call it gifted horse, and you know, when accidents happen at the distillery. What? So you guys went through that, and there was other thing I wanted to ask you about. What's the Bellagio Blue Wax story?
Oh, that was I'm also into wine. I've been into wine probably longer than
bourbon. Wait, I want to start this story.
Okay.
When I was living in Seattle, I had Vegas as my territory, so I was there quite a bit often.
Territory for what?
Sales.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I was sales of electrical and telecommunication equipment.
Gotcha.
So I was down there on business quite a bit, and the center bar at the Bellagio had this amazing bourbon selection. They pretty much had all the Van Winkles lineup. They had Hirsch Blue Wax. And as long as you were playing video poker at this bar, they would pour you whatever you wanted for free. Okay. So for $1 video poker, you sit there and slow play video poker and you can drink whatever you want. So every time I go to town, I would go to the Bellagio. So I guess I had told Randy they had the blue wax out there, and then he made a trip, and now he can take over.
So I'm in the cab line in Las Vegas airport going to our casino, and I see a friend of mine in the wine business. And he says, "Well, you know what, I'm meeting with the Bellagio beverage manager to taste through my wines at, I believe the restaurant was called Olives or something like that there. Why don't you join us?" And so, well, certainly that sounds fun. So we've all drank about 10 different of his Pinot Noirs. And I casually mentioned to her, I said, "Y'all have a whiskey here that's really phenomenal, and you're damn near giving it away at your bar. It's this Hirsch, and it's in a blue wax." And she had no idea. She's got so many products, and it was probably bought before her time. So she made a phone call, and she says, "Yeah, we've got a bar, and one of our restaurants has some." And I said, "Well, if you're willing to part with it, I'll get a room here at the Bellagio and buy it through room service, whatever it takes." And she says, "Well, if it's in that bar where it's really comping it to customers, I could probably pull it out of stock and trade you something for it." And I said, "Well, what do you like?" And she goes, "I like vintage ports." And I said, "Well, I think we can work a trade." So she got up. I believe she was able to put together a full case of Hirsch Blue Wax at that time. And we worked a trade for some ports that were in my cellar. And that's how I got it. And
so the next time I went to the Bellagio, there was no more blue wax.
And I ended up pouring it for friends and family and giving it away and things like that. Because there again, it really didn't have any
intrinsic value
other than, you know.
And now what does it go for?
I don't follow the market, but I'm sure it's several thousand dollars a bottle. If
thousand,
yeah,
I'd say.
Yeah. When I said you guys are living in a golden era, a diamond era would probably be more apropos. The stuff that happened back then, like just pouring it for free. I mean, I think the last time I was in Vegas, they poured me Macallan 18, and I felt honored to drink that $200 bottle of whiskey for free.
That was a good pour. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What did you bring today, Wade?
I brought a OGD, a National Distillers 86 proof. I believe it's from 1990. And then Old Fitz Bottled in a Bond, DSP KY16, so sits a Weller little whiskey there.
I have a little bit of that Old Fitz. I had Bernie Lubbers in last week. You ended up winning a trivia competition with him the next day.
He was at the trivia competition.
Yeah, it was his. He was hosting it.
Oh, good.
Yeah,
good,
so it was that day. Throw Flynn and our team, the ATF's anti-tater force,
killed it.
Came away with it.
Were you there?
No. So I did something with Harlan Wheatley that night.
Okay.
Was that the BT rep that you didn't want to mention?
No.
We did a whiskey tasting / vodka tasting with Harlan Wheatley that evening, and I ran over to Throw Flynn. You guys had already won the competition. We've talked a lot about Randy on the show. Let's talk a little bit about Wade. So Wade, for those who aren't familiar, although I'm sure there's a vast majority of you who are familiar with Wade, Wade's the consumer.
Let's talk more about Randy.
No. I was gonna say nice things. So you are the consumer advocate for in general when it comes to whiskey and transparency. I've got Mark Schilling coming on the podcast in a couple of weeks, as well as Dennis Rylander from Ranger Creek, and I want to do a few episodes. I want to do a few episodes centered around transparency and whiskey and honesty, and the reason why you are so adamant. And you run a blog called Tater Talk, which, for those who have followed the show so far, there's actually a pilot episode done of this show under a different name called Whiskey Babble, and that is on YouTube. And I thought about releasing on iTunes on this platform, but I haven't. Essentially, Wade is, I don't like to say blogger. You'd say blogger, right?
For sure. Tater Talk? It's a whiskey blog. That's what it does.
So tater-talk.com, Wade addresses issues in the whiskey world that are very worth talking about. So there was an issue recently with Crown Royal in which they put the word bourbon on their bottle, and you can't do that. So that was probably your most famous post to date.
Well, it was more that I was able to get in touch with someone for Crown Royal and find out exactly what happened with the label. And the fact is, the TTB did make them surrender the label. They initially approved it, but later on realized that you can't call a Canadian whiskey bourbon on the label. And they made them surrender the label, but they did give them up to 1 year to sell
the product. Sell what they had already bottled. So you've been known to fight for that cause, as well as you've been doing it now for what, almost 8 years?
A long time.
Yeah. So
maybe more like six. I guess when did the Texas distiller movement really get going? Maybe about 2009, 2010. I think it was that's kind of what got me into it, is you had some people really making whiskey here in Texas, and then all of a sudden you had these others that were doing nothing more than buying bulk whiskey from out of state and bottling it and putting Texas whiskey on it, and it just didn't seem fair to me. So that's really what got me into it.
Some of them even mixing it with vodka and or flavoring it and calling it a Texas whiskey. I actually covered a Buy This, Not That a few episodes back, in which I recommended not buying the 1835 whiskey that promotes as being a Texas made. It's got very, a San Antonio Cannon style Alamo look to it.
Right.
And it's not made here. It's bottled here, and it plays on your heartstrings of being a Texan.
And for the same price, you can buy legitimate Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey that's probably
age stated, higher proof.
So it's also, they're cashing in on Texans love to buy Texans products, and they're buying a product that's not really from Texas, but they don't know that.
Yeah, and there's actually a bit of a controversy over the logo Go Texan, which I'll get into more next week or in the next coming episodes with Mark Schilling, because there is a logo you can put on your Texas-made whiskey that encourages people to buy it because it's Texas, but it's not Texas.
Right.
So there's a bit of controversy around that. What's the word? Not support, but advocacy for, you know, what's the word when you...
Consumer watchdog advocacy.
No.
But I'm the Ralph Nader of the whiskey world.
When you promote a product, not consent, but when you advocate for a product, you're telling the consumer that you should buy this, when you endorse a product, and it's not, and it doesn't mean anything. So
that Go Texan was set up by the Texas Department of Agriculture, and it was designed to promote Texas agriculture products, which bourbon, because it's made from grains that can be obviously grown in Texas, it's a good product for that, but they don't have any requirement that any of the grains have to be grown to Texas to have that logo on it. The wine industry in Texas did have a change here probably 4 or 5 years ago, and now if a wine wants to have the Go logo Texas on it, they have to have 80% of the grapes actually grown here in Texas. I would like to see the same thing happen for a whiskey. You want the Go Texans logo on it, 80% of the grains need to come from Texas.
Or more.
Yeah, right.
Well, barley doesn't grow well here in Texas, unfortunately, that well, that good quality barley.
Fair enough.
So that would be the one grain that would be a little difficult.
Well, it's absolutely, I think it's a phenomenal idea, and I know that there are a lot of changes and ideas coming down the pipeline, which I don't know if we can talk about just yet. So moving on, I also wanted to ask you about the chill filtering tests with Truman Cox.
Yes, I wasn't there for this. I just heard the story from Randy, so this is definitely up his alley. So
yeah, Truman, rest in peace, was the lead chemist and quality control manager at Buffalo Trace. And he was convinced the average consumer couldn't tell the difference between chill filtering and non-chill filtered whiskey. So he decided to bring two samples to the gazebo, which those aren't your average consumers, first of all. So that was
correct.
Of,
yeah, yeah.
A little bit of a mistake, but on his part in terms of an assumption. But he brought two samples. Back then, it was Eagle Rare. And back then, because the sales were so slow, the Eagle Rare 10 was actually 14 years old. So he had two 14-year-old whiskeys, one that was chill filtered and one that was not. And that evening, there were 10 of us that decided to participate in this. And we were willing to go on the record, whether we called it, this is chill filtered or non-chill filtered.
Well, before we go down that path, let me just explain for those listening the chill filtration process. So essentially, when you have a spirit under 90 proof, give or take, if it's unchill filtered and it gets cold, then it becomes cloudy and murky. So what a lot of producers do, because you don't want people in like some northern states to think that the whiskey is bad, they will chill filter out all the oils in the whiskey, stripping the spirit from, you know, the oils from the spirit, and so that they maintain an aesthetic look. It's really just an aesthetic thing. And a lot of people argue that this does not affect the whiskey in any way, shape, or form, while many consumers like yourself and everyone at this table argue that you are stripping the product. There's going to be a result. We can tell it, and we hate it. Go ahead.
Right. So we've got 10 of us decided to participate. He thought that was a large enough sample that it would be meaningful. Well, 9 of the 10 of us got it right, that we picked the non-chill filtered from the chill filter.
Was better.
Well, that wasn't the question, but I think you're right. It was better. But could we tell the difference? And we picked the better one, and that was the unchill filtered. And the fellow that didn't was embarrassed because he was a pretty good whiskey taster.
Yeah.
And he was embarrassed that he was the only one that couldn't tell the difference. And Truman admitted, he says, boy, if 9 out of 10 can tell, then it's saying something.
Yeah. And now a lot of people, when they are talking about Buffalo Trace picks, they go bananas over anyone that's not chill filtered.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
If whiskey's over 100 proof, it really makes no difference. It's not going to cloud up.
Yeah.
Typically, if it gets
chill
cold.
Filtering above 95 or 100 proof,
yeah,
is
typically
pointless.
Yeah, below that, if it gets cold, it's going to cloud up some. So if you have a product like OWA that's 107 proof.
Old Weller Antique.
Yep.
Old Weller Antique. Yeah, there's really no need to chill filter it.
So in nowadays when whiskeys over that proof are chill filtered, it's usually due to the bottling line, right? So a lot of brands do it. Like, for instance, the way I understand it with Buffalo Trace is it's the bottling line is easier if it's chill filtered. So a lot of most old WA that comes off the line is chill filtered, which is why people go nuts when it's not chill filtered. And it's a bit more of a process for them to allow that to happen.
Right.
So, and speaking for advocacy of transparency, what did didn't you have a big story with Templeton? And I know I think we might have covered this on the first episode, but it's important that it gets covered on this.
Sure. One of the things that I discovered when I started digging into the actual federal laws, and there's federal laws that define what bourbon has to be and what these different whiskeys have to be. It's clearly defined. And one of the things that I found was, if the stated distillation is different than where it's actually bottled for certain whiskey types.
The state of or the stated?
The state of distillation.
Okay, so if it's not made in Texas.
Yeah, so if you're here in Iowa and you're saying that it's Templeton, Iowa whiskey, but it actually came from Indiana, 27 CFR 5.36D is the federal regulation that says the actual state of distillation has to be on the label.
Yeah.
So Templeton should have had put on the label distilled in Indiana, and they had not done this, and they were advertising it as a rye whiskey. So I contacted them. You can see when everybody submits a label who submitted it, and so I emailed that person, and if they would have listened to my advice, they could have saved themselves a lot of money in a class action lawsuit. But so, they never responded. Eventually, I was quoted in the Templeton Des Moines Register newspaper about the story. But the owner eventually had to settle a class action lawsuit about these labeling issues.
And what was the class action lawsuit that not just that it wasn't on there, but the label itself made it seem like it was very...
The label itself made it seem like they were distilling whiskey in Templeton, Iowa, according to the original Al Capone's bootlegger recipe,
right,
when really it was a standard bulk recipe whiskey distilled at MGP Rye in Indiana is what they were selling.
Right. And for those who aren't familiar, a big, big bulk source distiller, some of the most famous Kentucky, or some of the most famous bourbons out there aren't actually from Kentucky. The MGP Indiana produces Midwestern grain products. Sorry, my tongue's numb.
Yeah.
They produce hundreds of different bourbons, or I would say not hundreds of different bourbons,
there's
but
brands that bottle
100 different brands by their bulk source products. So they
what also kind of came out of this lawsuit, I'm sorry to interrupt
no,
you, but
fine.
I think this is interesting, is it came out of the lawsuit. One of the things they were doing to make it, quote, their unique recipe, is they were adding flavorings to this MGP whiskey.
Flavor packets.
We call them flavor packets, but basically it was a rye whiskey and not a straight rye whiskey. So for that category, they could add up to 2.5% coloring and different flavorings without disclosing it on the label. But it's something that probably would have never been known for sure, but the class action lawsuit, it came out in disclosure, so...
And they ended up losing a ton of money, right? So if you had ever, I think it was like if you had purchased a bottle of Templeton and within a certain number of years, you could turn it in and
I don't remember the exact amount, but you got like a $25 check or, yeah, but there was
a ton of money, yeah.
But they seem to be clicking along, so.
Yeah, and you're still fighting the good fight. So I know that you recently with the Crown Royal, and I know that you and I have had a few discussions ourselves about some Beam products that I thought were pretty interesting. So it's something that... If it wasn't for people like you raising the stink over situations like that, it wouldn't be talked about. People would get hoodwinked.
I appreciate
people
that,
still
Chris.
People still get hoodwinked. So
I do.
It's something that I've always said, you know, Wade comes off as abrasive, but it's because he's trying to fix a problem. So it's something I've always admired.
Well, let me add some right now. I think the bourbon industry has long enjoyed telling a story behind their products. And a lot of that story, you can't verify historically. This preacher accidentally charred a barrel and whiskey ended up in it. And there's just a bunch of stories out there. So to some extent, their past has had a lot of storytelling and maybe not being exactly truthful. And I think that has carried on into, well, the labeling, if you're close, that's good enough. And Wade has pointed out, no, there are some laws, and you can't do it that way. You can tell a little fib story, you know, add some character to the...
Some fluff, sure.
Some
marketing fluff.
When you get to certain specifics, age, proof, where it's from, and things like that, you have to get that part right.
Yeah, and it's because it's a direct reflection of how much money someone's going to spend on the product. And if you are convincing people to spend more for something that's, in layman's terms, bullshit, then it's not okay. So I appreciate it. I know that you, over time, have become people have understood that advocacy more, especially with Tater Talk. We talk, I feel like it's, and for those, I know I mentioned earlier, it's tater-talk.com, so tater-talk. And you, how often are you putting out stuff?
Oh, you know, like most bloggers, you start out really strong and it slows down. But I don't know. I think I've posted about – I started January 1st, and I think I have about 20, 25 topics, 3-4 times a month.
He's going to get a job someday and he may have to slow down.
So. I'm retired.
Okay. All right. He's retired.
For now. But right, if someone in the bourbon world is like, hey, we need you to double check, you really could start a business where you were the final – because I know that some local Texas distilleries have actually run things past you. Even Ed Bly's Old Baldy.
Yeah. Ed did.
Ed did an Old Baldy thing.
And he sent me a bottle for free for doing that. So that was very nice. So I work for bourbon,
nice.
I guess.
Yeah. So
nice.
He sent your – that should be on your Facebook page. Will work for bourbon. He sent you his label submission just to double check, because you can't trust a TTB, the governing body that double checks these things, because they do a cursory check and oftentimes will miss things. And that's the problem. It's the reason why Wade exists, is when you submit stuff to TTB, they do their best to make sure that it follows compliance, but often will miss things because of the person doing the approval is human, and they don't necessarily understand all the legal jargon to the best of a lawyer.
For many years, there were 8 companies that owned 13 distilleries that made 99.9% of a whiskey sold in America, and they had very limited labels they would submit to the TTB for approval. Well, the craft whiskey movement over the past 10 years has gone crazy, so the net amount of labels being submitted to them has
skyrocketed.
You know, 1,000-fold what it used to be.
Right.
Now they've automated through some computer systems where now, you know, you're doing everything online, but they accept producers' words that if a producer turns in a label, that the producer knows what he's talking about.
Well, there's a perjury requirement when you submit.
Yeah, there is a statement that says, under penalty of perjury, by submitting this label, it meets all federal labeling laws.
And that's a way for them to just slough the responsibility of doing the due diligence per label.
It is, but then when these companies get sued, like Templeton, what they always try to do in the court cases is say, well, the TTB approved my label. It's a legal concept known as safe harbor, and the courts have consistently said, yeah, but when you turned in that label, you signed a statement saying it complied with all federal laws, and you didn't. So therefore, safe harbor doesn't apply. But generally, a lot of companies, when I approach them initially and say, hey, your label doesn't meet it, that's what they'll come back to me and say, was the TTB approved it.
Yeah.
And I say, well, you may think that, but that's not legally the case. Right. So.
And that's often their legitimate thought. They're thinking that if it was approved, it's fine. Mm-hmm. So it's often – there are some that I know have just ignored your emails or decided not to listen.
But there's plenty that have listened and said, hey, I wasn't aware of that. We'll make the change. So 50-50, but
yeah. Well, I applaud you for it. I also wanted to going back to the single barrel thing. I mentioned that you had kind of started this whole thing, and you are. And just to recap, right now in today's society, in today's bourbon world, the holy grail, the thing that you hope for in bourbon collecting, is that one single barrel that changes everything, otherwise known as the honey barrel. And with allocations being very slim in the realm of BTAC and Pappy, you can reasonably find a single barrel bourbon that's 14 years old for $40 and hope that it's that snowflake, that diamond in the rough. And none of that would be where it is today if it wasn't for people like you, Randy Blank, and Doug Jones.
So, Doug Phillips.
Doug Phillips. And you actually – So after you started doing it, then the Kentucky, what'd you say, Kentucky Bourbon?
KBS. Kentucky Bourbon Society.
Kentucky Barrel Society.
Barrel Society. I knew it wasn't bourbon. Yeah. Kentucky Barrel Society. And then Doug Phillips started doing a lot with Willett, which is actually what you brought today. Tell us a little bit about the famous Doug Phillips's Willett picks.
Yeah, Doug was a big rye fan, and he had been introduced to Drew Coolsveen and found out he had a supply of aged ryes. And I think
a lot of them.
And so this was about a year or so after I did my barrel. And, you know, Doug put a small group together. I think they called themselves the East Bay Study Group. But so Doug had some cohorts out there in California, in the Bay Area, and got some samples of this older rye and did a couple of different single barrels out there. What was a little bit different about theirs is Willett kind of wanted it all pre-sold and the money up front. So that's how I got my involvement, because I was good friends with Doug. And Doug called me up and says, Randy, we found this barrel of rye we really want to buy, but we got to basically sell it all in advance. Would you buy a case? And I'm like, well, how much is it going to be? And he says, it's $60. And, you know, this is a 2005. $60 was kind of an upper limit.
Especially for rye. There weren't a lot of rye drinkers back then. Really.
And I hadn't tasted it yet. And I said, okay, Doug, I'm good for a case. And shortly thereafter, I was making a trip to California and went to see him and tasted the samples before it was bottled. And I'm like, wow, I'm glad I did.
Even though I wasn't a
big rye drinker, I drank a lot of it in Manhattans and other mixed drinks. But when I got my case, I was very happy with it. And but Doug went on to do several. He's known for a couple of his older ryes, the 22-year-old ryes, but he also did some young whiskeys that were very good, some 4-year-old bottles. Did some 17-year-olds. He did quite a few.
Randy, I know there's one story that we've talked about, and I hope you share it with us.
Well, recently, too, as of 15 minutes ago.
The Pappy 23 straight bourbon pick.
Sure, I'll tell it one more time. And as I mentioned earlier, the distilleries make a lot of mistakes when they bottle single barrels and whatnot. And without getting any of them, let's talk about this one. In 2007, the owners of the StraightBourbon.com forum and the group, the Kentucky Barrel Society, decided to do a Pappy 23 single barrel pick. And, of course, Julian had to cooperate. And in 2007, Julian mentioned that he had had a surplus of Pappy 23, 23-year-old Stitzweller barrels, more than he thought he could market at that time.
So, I'm sorry, real quick. You said, originally when you first approached them that Buffalo Trace was hesitant.
That was mine.
Okay.
That was the Van Blankel. That was back in 04.
So a website, they were more easier inclined to it because of it being what straight bourbon was back then.
And they had started doing some. They did a Buffalo Trace bottling, just a straight Buffalo Trace single barrel with a small group. So they eased their way into it. And so
they started seeing the possibility has. Right. Most distilleries are worried about selling stuff by the case, and now you can sell stuff by the barrel. It was a little bit easier to...
You know, so I had done mine. The Kentucky Barrel Society had done the Weller 12 in 2005. So that part of their business...
They
actually built a single barrel bottling room because they were getting into just doing the single barrels.
See what I mean about you starting everything? It's pretty awesome.
I just happened to be there at the time. But so anyway, our group, the Kentucky Barrel Society, in conjunction with StraightBourbon.com, is going to pick some Pappy 23 single barrels. So there's about 9 of us, and we get to the tasting area, which is a cool spot at Buffalo Trace, and they roll out 5 barrels of Pappy 23-year-old. Julian's there, Preston's there, and the warehousemen are there, and they look at the barrels that are rolled out for us, and they're over there huddling, discussing in whispers.
Something's wrong.
Clearly something's wrong. And so Julian comes to us and says, I apologize, guys. I had actually handpicked out the barrels for y'all to taste today. These are not those barrels. These are barrels that were going to be dumped at our next bottling of Pappy 23. And so we said, well, did we want to move forward? And we all said, well, let's just taste what's here. If we don't like anything, we won't. Obviously, we don't have to buy one. So we go through the tasting and we find actually 3 of the 5 barrels that we like and actually purchase 3 of the barrels. So we asked Julian, well, what was unique about the barrels he had picked? And he says, well, I picked out, I thought were some pretty good ones. And I had actually thrown in a stinker barrel, a barrel that was too woody, too tannic, too much char in
it. Just garbage.
Just garbage. He said it would be dumped. He said there was no use for it. And I was going to put it in there to see if you guys would be honest with me and tell me that this tastes like you know what. And so we said, well, I'm glad we didn't have to taste that. What happened to it? And he says, it's my understanding that that barrel got dumped.
Got blended
off in the Pappy 23 that year. And
that was what?
2007.
2007, just so we know that we just tanked the secondary market. Yeah. Pappy Van Winkle.
Don't have to buy that anymore.
There was actually two releases, two bottlings. He would do it because he didn't bottle that much at a time. He might do two a year of the Pappy 23. So whatever was in the vicinity of that time had that stinker barrel put into it.
And a lot of, and we've talked about this recently locally, a lot of what happens with single barrels versus batched barrels. So anytime you do a batch of something like Booker's, it's 300 barrels, usually around 30,000 bottles per release, give or take. When you do a batch like that, you can blend off the bad barrels, right? You can kind of average it out, you know, sure, and hit that profile while still capitalizing on the whiskey that had been aging for that long. And with barrel programs, a lot of times they will pick stuff that's off profile to set aside for barrel picks.
Yep.
Which is essentially what he did there. So that concept carried over to what we do now. You mm-hmm. know,
I
know.
Yeah, he was trying to trick them there.
Yeah, I know. But that concept still ended up becoming the standard, because I know that with Wild Turkey, with Knob Creek, all the major producers, even Four Roses, they try to set aside barrels they think that are not exactly what the average shelf item is. So there are some that try to keep it consistent. I think Buffalo Trace. Some guy locally, Casey Sue, had mentioned that they had picked a barrel of OWA that was off profile, and it got pulled from them because it didn't taste like
it was too far off profile, and they didn't want something in the marketplace that would say, this is old Weller Antique.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's not.
Yeah, this is going to hurt our brand.
Right, right.
So I prefer the brands that will go out there and actually, and you know, this is really unique and interesting. Let's set this aside to see if someone likes it. And you guys just happen to do it with a Pappy 23, which how many Pappy 23 picks were out there currently?
None.
Well, I mean, I know they're not doing it anymore.
It's my understanding there was either a retailer or a small group in New York that he did some from. The Premier Group, I think, up in New York may have done a Pappy 23 single barrel. Not many.
But it hasn't been done in over a decade.
No, not at all.
He used to do some one-offs, like he did an 18-year-old for Sam's up in before.
What was Twisted
Chicago?
Twisted? Then that's what really got my ideal to do my selection, is that I've had the one at Delilah's, I'd had the one at Twisted Spoke, the one out in San Francisco was the Slanted Door. It did a lot B single barrel. So I had had some, and that's what kind of gave me the idea that, wow, if they can get one, why can't an individual? And I'd like to be the one picking it.
Yeah.
And not a group or whatnot. So I did it myself. But actually tasting the Twisted Spoke and the Delilah's kind of gave me a little bit of the inspiration to do one myself.
How old was Twisted Spoke?
It was a 16-year-old.
16, yeah, that's what I thought.
And he didn't have a 16-year-old at the time in a regular bottling, but he was doing the Black Maple Hill 16 at that time.
Oh, Black Maple Hill.
When he was bottling it, it's the Black Maple Hill 16. I'm on record that that's one of my favorite
whiskeys. One of your favorites of all time.
I don't think that was ever sold in Texas, though. Did you ever find it in Texas?
I found it in California.
I bought a few bottles of it, and mine came from California as well, which is obviously where the company was bottling it for was located. Black Maple.
Yeah, well, in general, Texas, I know that Texas is a big market focus for a lot of brands now, especially the last couple of years. But historically, I mean, we got everything. We still get everything late, you know, even the old Fitz. There's a lot of stuff that never makes it down here, especially with Foursquare. Are you a rum drinker at all?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so Foursquare has a lot of great stuff that never makes it this way.
What's Robert's last name at Foursquare?
Robert Seale.
Richard Seale.
Yeah. Richard Seale. Good guy.
I know there was a recent article published on one of the online forums about how they're kind of a lot of people don't even know that there are other distilleries on the island because of Foursquare. The focus is all on them.
Okay.
And they're producing, the Valier releases are just incredible.
Tell us about some of your favorite Valier releases.
Why drive up the price of my favorite rums? They're hard enough to find as it is.
But they're expensive too, man. I think that's the next movement. Armagnacs and rums, yeah. I think, are the next.
We did a, are still in the group end. And Randy and I were in, they did a rum tasting one time, and there was some rums that were exceptional. And Randy was smart enough to go out and find some bottles in Europe while they were still available. Now, I think they're pretty much all gone. But
Well, there were things that were never available here, and once you tasted them, you were like, wow, why aren't they? And they're just outstanding.
Habitation Valier got their – they have like an importer – which also handles their marketing side, and they finally got it for the U.S.
Right.
And it's in New York.
Yeah, and they hired a girl, Kate Perry, who's correct. Fantastic.
Yeah, I was getting there, Kate Perry. Yeah. But they, we've approached her several times, like, Texas is ready for you. Like, as soon as you're ready, we've got distribution lined up. And they're not ready because apparently it's just like her and a couple other people in New York. Like, they're focusing on that side of the U.S. But the moment it hits Texas, it's gonna explode. Some of the best rums out there.
Yep.
And it's comparable in price and quality to some of your favorite whiskeys.
The fellow behind that is Luca.
Luca Grigori.
Yeah.
I think it's Grigori. Yeah. Double check.
Yeah, but Luca's a nice fellow.
He's super nice.
He's been to New Orleans at Tails a couple of times, and I've had the chance to sit down and drink some, literally sit on the floor in the hotel room and open up some of his bottles and drink with him. And he's bottled some outstanding stuff over time.
And they're consistently putting it out there, you know, and cash strength, right. Hand selected, and it's reasonably priced. I mean, even their 2-year-old Foursquare was, I don't know if you tasted that, but it was just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
2-year-old rum.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Luca.
Yeah, what am I haven't had here?
Handy?
I haven't had some of the Handy. I'll try a little bit of that.
Handy is always good, but tasting it. Almost back-to-back with this. Yeah, it's really not fair.
It's unfortunate.
I know. It's not fair.
It's stacking the deck.
Yeah, that Straight Bourbon 23 Pappy. I was a member of Straight Bourbon at the time, and it was offered to the members there. And I passed because I've never liked Pappy 23. I've tasted it many, many times and always thought it was just too oaky for my taste. And
that's good.
Kicking myself. That was one of my worst mistakes, I think. But
when you talk to Bernie Lovers, he was saying that historically, a lot of distillers, a lot of classic bourbon drinkers in the 80s, they didn't trust the older stuff. They felt like it was the reject stuff. And now the focus is on the old stuff. And I agree with you. I think that, in my opinion, that sweet spot's in that 12-year range, give or take, with, you know, cash strength. 23-year-old Pappy's good, and it's an experience. Like, it's for a lot of younger when you go through stages, but when you finally get old enough to have a little bit of liquid income and you start collecting, Pappy 23 is like, it's an experience. Then you get a little older and you've got plenty of money and you don't give a crap about that. You'd rather buy vintage bourbon from the 80s and younger.
To me, the sweet spot of the Pappy lineup, and I'm talking back when it was a Stetson Weller whiskey.
15?
It was a 15-year-old. The 15-107 was definitely one of my top five whiskeys ever in the old squat bottle.
That's probably, of the Van Winkle lineup, that's the one I have the most bottles of.
Is it 15?
It's 15. It was.
Let's
it was
leave here and go to Randy's.
Yeah, yeah. How many bottles do you think you're sitting on?
Not that many, maybe a case and a half.
No, I'm sorry. Oh. Overall, in your whiskey collection, in the realm of, in the library of blank.
It's about 300 or so, that. It's not as many as a lot of guys have now. I've slowed down here recently. Well, and my interest have
expanded.
Well,
you branched out.
Have expanded.
I know that you're a big cigar guy. You've also expanded into wine deeply.
Wine, rum, and Armagnacs more recently. So, I've expanded.
Real recently.
I probably not bought a bourbon off the shelf. Can't remember when.
It's this hobby, once you branch out into places like, you know, we've talked Lincoln-Tada, this Armagnac is a bourbon drinker's Armagnac. It's incredible. Cash strength at almost 55%. 21 years old and it's $70. You're not going to find the same thing in bourbon. It's going to be twice that price.
Yeah.
Not anymore. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, yes, but not now.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So. Back in the day. And you've got a pretty extensive selection of cigars I've experienced at your house. Cuban all the way.
Yeah, no, I've got several vices, but enjoy sharing them with people.
But that's what retirement's for, is right. To get to that point where you right. just enjoy life a little bit. You know, there's that old saying, live like no one else so that later you can live like no one else. Like, I want to, you know, kill it now. And you guys have done quite a bit of traveling, and now you're just enjoying everything.
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah. Enjoy. Well, I appreciate both of you guys coming. I know that it's not too far from you or you. I mean, you're in Cyprus, right? You're not too far.
Not too far.
But. Give or take. Thanks so much for coming, guys. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Chris, thanks, man.
Thanks so much.
I've enjoyed it.
I've had a ball. I appreciate it. Randy Blank and Wade Woodard. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Cheers.
Cheers.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.